Hello there. Today is Tuesday, September 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump prepares for his first address to the UN General Assembly. Another monster storm is taking aim at already hard-hit areas.
We seek a United Nations that regains the trust of the people around the world.
Could there be more changes coming to the president's staff? Also ahead, why dogs are so much friendlier than their wild cousins. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump has said he long ago recognized the promise of the United Nations when he chose a spot across the street to build a residential tower. The president made his UN debut Monday, speaking at a U.S.-hosted meeting on reforming how the world body is managed, held on the sidelines of the annual UN General Assembly.
The United Nations has not reached its full potential because of bureaucracy and mismanagement, while the United Nations on a regular budget has increased by 140% and its staff has more than doubled since 2000, we are not seeing the results in line with this investment.
Well, the UN, with its multi-billion dollar annual budget, numerous peacekeeping missions, and bloated staff, has been a target of Trump's criticism for years. The United States is the UN's largest single donor, contributing more than $600 million last year to the regular budget. Washington also contributes more than $2 billion annually to support UN peacekeeping missions and hundreds of millions more to vital programs, including the UN Children's Fund and the World Food Program. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley also calling for reforms.
In the coming weeks and months, we will be considering the Secretary General's broader vision. This is an opportunity for all of us to seize this moment and ensure that the United Nations remains relevant.
President Trump will make his first major speech before the entire General Assembly on Tuesday. And joining me now for what to expect later today is U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan and Serbia and current president of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter. Thank you for being with us. So what do you think will be the main focus of the president's speech?
The thing that everyone's worried about today is North Korea.
Right.
And that will be the topic of discussion, I think, when the president speaks tomorrow at the UN. And it will be expected that he'll address that. I think we've gotten a taste of what the United States will be saying from Ambassador Haley, who has been, I would describe, fairly tough about saying that if diplomacy doesn't work, if other countries are not able to press the North Koreans, that she is, quote, something like willing to turn it over to Mattis, saying that the military option is not off the table. In that region makes a lot of people very nervous, and I think that the president's meetings with the South Koreans and the Japanese will be very, very important. President Xi, I believe, will not be at these meetings, but Trump will meet with other people who are important. In addition, the UN will, of course, be talking about Syria at the UN. They will be talking about Libya. They will be talking about Iran and the nuclear deal in Iran and other hot issues. It's one of those kind of times when just drawing a distinction between what is important and what is urgent, it's kind of hard to do that. There's so many things that are important and so many things that are urgent that the plate is very full. But I would put North Korea at the top of the list.
Are you at all concerned by recent tweets and how the president will conduct himself at the UN, especially with the fact that we're hearing, you know, he's going to continue with this America First, which sort of seems contrary to what the UN is all about?
You know, it's funny. I've heard European correspondents saying things like, we're now at the point where we're really taking the measure of Trump. My feeling is, you know, you've had 8 months to take the measure of Trump. I think, you know, he's not going to change. It's not likely that he's going to overnight become someone who's a supporter of the UN or acts in a different way. My point has always been, I believe very firmly, that the president is not a man who is primarily a traditional foreign policy thinker, but a man whose foreign policy ideas emanate from his commitment to his domestic agenda and his commitment to serving those who he believes are his constituency in the United States. So that the way to figure out what he's going to do is to try to figure out what he wants to say to his still very loyal supporters, and not to try to figure out what he thinks about Korea or not to think what he thinks about Libya or another issue, if that makes any sense. So that's what I encourage foreigners to do. Don't look for him to have an about-face about the UN or for him to act different and stop tweeting. Look to him to try to continue And that's not what people are used to at the UN. It's a new style, and I think people do have to get used to that. But it's not going to be a surprise. It's going to be more of what he's been doing for 8 months.
Lastly, I would just ask you, you know, Sunday there was a lot of tweeting going on with the president, and one of the things that he did was to sort of come up with a nickname, which he likes to do for people, coming up with a nickname of Rocket Man for North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Where do you stand on that? Is that a problem? Is it okay? Is it funny?
Personally, I mean, the essence of diplomacy is empathy. The essence of diplomacy is thinking how others think, not necessarily agreeing with what they think, but having a sense of why other people do things, especially when you don't agree with them. When you make a nickname for someone, when you make a caricature of someone, you're not really engaging in empathy. Now, it may be that that's just not the way he sees it, and that that's not the way that this particular administration wants to go about diplomacy. But I personally believe that the more you try to understand other people, and especially, I would say, when they don't believe, that they don't agree with you, that's when you're going to find that there's common ground, if there is going to be common ground. And so, yes, when he does come up with this kind of tweet, I don't see it as furthering diplomacy, but I see it as utterly consistent with the President Trump that we've known up until now. And there's no reason for us to think that he's going to change.
All right. Former U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan and Serbia and current president of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter, thank you for your time. Well, as world leaders gather in New York for the U.N. General Assembly, another monster storm is taking aim at already pummeled areas in the Caribbean. Maria has intensified into a Category 5 hurricane. Dennis Feltgen with the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida, said Maria, which continues to gain strength, will be extremely destructive.
Unfortunately, it is impacting many of the islands which were severely damaged by Irma just a week to 10 days ago. It's not an identical path, but it is still in the same general area. So this is not helping the situation down there at all.
Well, the storm will take aim at the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, among others, but it's too soon, he says, to know whether it will also have a direct impact on the east coast of the U.S.
It's far too early to tell what, if any, impacts will be felt on the U.S. mainland. Our five-day track still has it to north of the Dominican Republic, so the United States mainland still has plenty of time to watch it.
Well, given the record-breaking strength of these storms, there are renewed fears about how to manage the population boom in cities like Miami as risks of climate change intensify. Rising sea levels and spreading floodplains have magnified the vulnerabilities for the legions of people continuing to move to places like Florida. And while scientists say climate change isn't causing the hurricanes, they say it is making them much more powerful. Joining me now to discuss is Steve Herz, senior attorney with the Sierra Club's international programs. Thanks for being with us. So are these powerful storms going to be the new norm?
It's certainly what we expect to see going forward. There's a lot of attention being paid to has climate change caused these hurricanes or intensified them. And while there's a lot of evidence for that, in some ways it's not really the best question. The best question is this the sort of thing that we're going to see more and more? Is this a harbinger of what storms will be like in a changing climate?
What's the answer?
The answer to that is yes. This is exactly the sort of thing that meteorologists are predicting we will see more of in a changing climate. We'll have warmer water, warmer air, both of which cause more intense storms and more rainfall. And on top of that, we will see sea level rise. So the stronger storms will make landfall on top of higher seas, which will lead to more intense coastal flooding.
And so all of these things will have a pretty big impact, not just on the United States, but obviously the whole entire planet, how we live, where we live, food. Is that pretty accurate as well?
Yes. There are a lot of other areas that are similarly exposed to more intense tropical storms. We've seen that in the Philippines. We've seen that in Bangladesh. Numerous areas around the world where people will be exposed to increasingly intense storms. And in many cases, those people don't have even less resources and are even more poorly prepared to deal with those impacts than we are here in the United States.
Given all these factors and given the devastation that we've seen, which is obviously going to cost billions, and I know there's been a lot of talk about whether there should even be things rebuilt in some of these areas, especially in Florida, but the current administration has questioned climate change at all, much less whether or not humans are contributing to this. That is contrary to most of the world. Recently, people were bringing up the fact that these storms were intense. This is climate change. We need to address it. We need to deal with it. We need to find new and innovative ways of dealing with what's to come. But Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt said that now is not the time to talk about climate change in the midst of these horrific natural disasters, that it's insensitive. What is the Sierra Club's policy on that?
I don't know that we have a policy, but I would say that, of course, now is the right time to talk about the threats we're all exposed to as a result of a changing climate. The time to talk about the threats that we face is when those threats are most immediate. And so I don't think it's insensitive to talk about what has happened and the implications of it, or the causes of it and the implications going forward. So, for example, the Republican mayor of Miami wants to talk about it. He said that if this isn't climate change, I don't know what is. And the reason he wants to talk about it is because it's his city, it's his people that have to deal with the direct impacts. The people who don't want to talk about it are the people who want to deny the scientific consensus. But it's deeply irresponsible not to talk about causes when we know that they're going to be a factor in how we plan going forward to deal with the impacts of more intense storms, and even to rebuild from the damages that were caused by the two hurricanes that we just saw.
How concerned are you that, given that perspective, that now is absolutely the time to start really talking about this stuff? Where does that leave us with an administration that isn't in agreement with that point of view?
Well, hopefully, as devastating as these two storms were and the horrible human costs of the damages, the loss of life and property, the dislocations, hopefully that will open up a more honest conversation with people who have not yet been willing to confront the implications of climate change. Traditionally, it's been small government conservatives that haven't wanted to talk about climate change because they realize that dealing with climate change may require government action, and they don't support bigger government. But what Hurricanes Harvey and Irma should show those folks is that the costs of not dealing with climate change are huge, enormous, intolerable, and that dealing with the aftermath of climate-related extreme events is far more costly and implies far more government action than avoiding the problem in the first place by reducing emissions. And so hopefully these folks will come to see that reducing emissions will not only help avoid the misery and dislocation and the loss of life and property, but is actually should be the favored approach for small government conservatives, because dealing with the problem ahead of time implies less government action than trying to deal with the impacts after the fact.
All right, Steve Hurst, Senior Attorney for the Sierra Club's International Programs. Thank you so much. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. St. Louis protests enter a fourth day in the wake of a former policeman's acquittal. UN investigators say perpetrators of crimes in Syria must face justice. Somalia gets its first forensic lab dedicated to rape investigations. And President Trump's confident there is a chance of Israeli-Palestinian peace. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, so what's going on here and abroad? So much going on here and abroad. And anything that people are really focusing on?
There is a lot to talk about, but a lot of people are focused on the situation in Myanmar with the Rohingya people, of course, fleeing from that country. Terrible scenes from there. And the one that was trending today was this scene of a woman named Hamida. Her husband and her family were trying to escape via boat. Their boat capsized. Hamida and her husband survived, but their two-month-old baby did not. And so this image of Hamida holding her dead child in her hands has gone viral. It's drawing attention to the plight of the Rohingya people as they're fleeing Myanmar, but also as they're being turned away from other countries. And this photo in particular was so heartbreaking and resonated with so many people. It really did spread around the internet and really put a lot of attention onto their plight.
Well, I mean, hopefully something good can come out of such a horrific tragedy, a mother having to lose an infant like that. Just heartbreaking. Hopefully it will draw more attention to the plight of these people.
Well, that's the hope, that if there's anything that can come out of this horrible story, it's that it does draw more attention from around the world. And that's actually become a point of contention on social media, because as the Rohingya people are trying to share their plight on social media, some are claiming that social networks, specifically Facebook, are removing their content and blocking them from trying to get this out to the world. There are claims that accounts have been suspended, that content has been removed. But it's not clear whether it's active censorship or if it's just removing content that has violated terms of services. We've seen this happen before with videos that are particularly violent or photos that are very disturbing. They can be removed from social media, not because of necessarily that they're trying to depict these people and their plight, but because they violate a specific set of rules. So Facebook has released a statement. They say that in response to the situation in Myanmar, we are carefully reviewing content against our community standards. So I imagine they'll elaborate on that in the coming days. They'll have to address this and say, well, even though this is a violent image, or even though this video is disturbing, it's depicting the plight of these people, so we'll allow it. There's a lot of gray area when it comes to those terms of service, and I think this will be one of those instances.
Well, meanwhile, Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi is scheduled to give a highly anticipated national speech Tuesday, addressing her country's crisis, where the ongoing violence has led to about 400,000 ethnic Rohingya to flee to neighboring Bangladesh. And thanks again, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Well, as the UN General Assembly gets underway and speculation ramps up about what President Trump will say, there is also some question about how big of a role America's top diplomat, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, will play. My next guest is Ellis Hennekin, columnist for Metro US and author of the upcoming comedy book called Trumpitude. And you've got a theory, apparently, Ellis, about some changes you think will be coming to the administration.
Well, look at Ambassador Haley, right? I mean, she is, I would say, one of the more ambitious members of the upper levels of the Trump administration. She has some personal charm and charisma. I think she presents well, and she has political ambition. And so I think that Rex Tillerson needs to be keeping an eye over his shoulder. There's already talk about whether she might be the next Secretary of State. There are some people who say that she is the de facto Secretary of State. But, I think there's a clash that's coming, and I would not bet against Nikki Haley.
Rex Tillerson has to some degree gutted the State Department. No new hires, lots of them leaving, lots of positions gone unfilled. Is that a Rex Tillerson thing, or is that a Trump administration thing? And would that change with a Secretary of State, Nikki Haley, if that were to be the case?
You know, the term low-key barely begins to describe
describe Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State. He has gone against one of the almost immutable laws of government bureaucracy, which is you want to get more power, more influence, more budget, more people. In almost every single one of his instances, he's gone the other way. And it raises a lot of questions. What does he want to do? Is he there to diminish the power of diplomacy? We do not yet have what I would call really a Tillerson view of the world other than speak softly and walk softly.
You know, there have been rumors that President Trump wasn't happy with him, but we haven't really seen any outward, you know, criticism of him like he has with some of his other staffers that are actually still working for him, like Jeff Sessions.
That's right. And in many ways, on a personal level, they seem like they're okay with each other. There haven't been any, you know, great leaks about, you know, vicious blow-ups. But it's strange. It's strange because here we are 8 months in about, and he just hasn't really made his mark. He has this organizational study that's been going on, and if you ask the officials in the State Department what's happening, they say, well, we're still waiting the results of this organizational study. But in the meantime, a large number of positions have gone unfilled. The secretary has offered large budget cuts, which, again, is not something that cabinet secretaries usually do. So it's just a strange one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it would seem like more than ever now we need diplomacy and we need diplomats around the world dealing with some of these very difficult issues, especially in North Korea.
And one of the interesting things is that the greatest voices in the administration on behalf of diplomacy have come from the military officials. General Mattis, especially, has spoken quite eloquently about how important diplomacy is and how a military might always needs to be the last resort, and how the military and the diplomats need to work in coordination with each other. And that's how you have an effective foreign policy. Most of that argument truly has come out of the Pentagon.
Interesting. Is it sort of in jest that you're saying expect the president to send a signal on Haley's future, or do you seriously believe that he will do something to that effect?
I think there's serious maneuvering going on right now between Tillerson and Haley, and I think both are watching for responses from the president. The U.N. General Assembly is normally a time where the U.N. ambassador takes a step back and allows the Secretary of State to be the strongest, clearest, predominant voice of the administration, other, of course, than the president. Let's just watch what happens over the next couple of days and see who it is, other than President Trump, is speaking for the United States of America. And I will bet you that the voice of Nikki Haley is going to be a whole lot louder and a whole lot clearer than we would normally get from a U.N. ambassador.
Do you think that Rex Tillerson is on board with this, or do you think he's just sort of being pushed aside?
My sense is that he's not going to be here very long. Listen, it's always hard to predict anything in the Trump administration, but if you are predicting, keep an eye on future Secretary of State Nikki Haley.
Lastly, I would just ask, what do you think we can expect from Donald Trump's speech? Do you think that he'll stay on script and be teleprompter Donald Trump, or do you think he'll be the other Trump that just speaks off the cuff and says things that can sometimes be interpreted in ways that get him into trouble?
Oh, I think the big Tuesday address is going to be a teleprompter speech. And the tone is likely to have some criticism in it, but a gentler criticism. Hold on for later in the week, though. He'll be back out on the rally stump, and then we will get Donald Trump unplugged again.
All right. Thanks so much. That's columnist for Metro US and author of the upcoming book, Trumpitude, which will be available on Amazon. That's Ellis Hennekin. Thanks for being with us. U.S. researchers have identified a genetic difference between dogs and their wild cousins, the wolves, that could explain why dogs are so friendly. Faith Lapidus reports.
How did this evolve into this? A new study shows that today's friendly pups are the result of generations of domestication and genetics.
I happened to make contact with Bridget von Holt, who is a professor at Princeton University, and she had recently discovered a genetic divergence between dogs and wolves that was located in the same area that had previously been implicated in the development of something called Williams-Buren syndrome in humans.
One of the characteristics of that rare congenital disorder is an excessively friendly and outgoing personality. Williams syndrome, as it's also known, is caused by genetic mutations in a specific region of chromosome 7. That's equivalent to the region in the canine genome associated with sociability. The variation in those genes led to the pro-social behavior of domestic dogs, who are friendlier even than wolves raised by humans.
Where dogs and wolves are both interested in people, wolves will typically come, engage in a short sort of adult-type greeting, and then move on back to their normal behaviors, whereas dogs will come and greet a person and greet them again and continue to greet them, whether or not that person is reciprocating that affection. And in some cases, they'll be just as enthusiastic with strangers as they are with their own owners.
The study by Udell and Von Holt, published in Science Advances, confirms that both nature and nurture played a role in making our best friends as friendly as they are. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Recently, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted Resolution 2373, which extends the mandate of the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, for another year. UNIFIL has been in Lebanon for nearly four decades. However, after the Hezbollah-Israeli conflict in 2006, it was charged with monitoring the cessation of hostilities and accompanying and supporting the Lebanese armed forces as they deployed in southern Lebanon. UNIFIL was also mandated to assist the Lebanese armed forces to establish southern Lebanon as an area free of any armed personnel, assets, and weapons, other than those of the Lebanese government or UNIFIL. The newly adopted resolution strengthens this mandate and comes at a time when the United States and others have pointed out that Hezbollah, responsible for initiating the 2006 conflict, has not only rebuilt but increased its arsenal in Lebanon over the past decade. U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley welcomed the renewal of UNIFIL's mandate. This resolution gives UNIFIL robust authority to help Lebanon keep the South safe. What we sought in this renewal is to make sure UNIFIL is doing its job to the fullest extent possible. Ambassador Haley called current conditions in southern Lebanon very dangerous. At the direction of its patron Iran, the terrorist organization Hezbollah has thousands of missiles and thousands of trained fighters, all beyond the control of the Lebanese government. The renewal of UNIFIL's mandate by the Security Council, among other measures, calls for UNIFIL to step up its patrols and inspections, thereby helping to disrupt Hezbollah's illegal activity. More importantly, Ambassador Haley noted, the renewed mandate requires UNIFIL to report when it is prevented from seeing something it wants to inspect. From now on, when the peacekeepers encounter a Hezbollah roadblock, she said, they have to tell us the details of where, when, and why they got stopped. This transparency will put an end to the ignorance about what's really going on in southern Lebanon. For the United States, this is a time for strength, resolve, and accountability at the United Nations, Ambassador Haley declared. The renewal of the UNIFIL mandate, she emphasized, is an important step, but there is much more to do. Just as Hezbollah is stepping up its efforts, the United States and now the United Nations are stepping up our efforts against them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.